Welcome to Spiritually Hungry. Today, we're going to talk about grief. We've talked about grief before, and you can check out those episodes. It was episode 1, 41, and 42, but we felt it was necessary to have an even deeper conversation on this topic. Grief is something that most everyone will experience at some point in their life, and it's also a topic that most people do not like to talk about. Our guest today is actor, performer, director, Grant Gehry. Grant directed the documentary Meet Me Where I Am, and it's an exploration of grief. We're going to talk about that and really unpack many different ideas, so join us. Hello, Grant. Thank you for joining us today. I think it's serendipitous that we're actually speaking about this week. My grandmother passed away 5 days ago.
Literally a week ago.
Oh, a week ago. Yeah, we flew to LA and right back again. And then my father passed 3 years before that, and Michael's mother 4 years ago, who was I was very close to as well, a mentor. So I've given a lot of thought to grief and different stages of grief and how we grieve people differently for different reasons. So we're really excited to have this conversation with you today. To start with, I'd love to know what personal experience, if any, inspired you to do a documentary on grief, because it's not a super, let's say, sexy title. Your documentary is Meet Me Where I Am, and it's an exploration of grief. But it's a topic, I mean, quite frankly, most people avoid because it reminds us of our own demise or losing something that we don't want to lose, whether it's, you know, divorce or the ability to use our body as we did or death. So tell us, what got you here?
Yeah, it's true. I mean, you're right. You're right in that it can be so many things. It can be the death of a person. It can be the death of a relationship, both of which I've had, experience with. So that helped inform me making this film. My own lived personal experience of loss has helped me with this film. And, you know, originally one of the people in the film, they had come to me when they were in, I don't want to say like a bout of deep grief, but they were, you know, certainly in it, for lack of a better phrase. And they wanted to show people what grievers go through, which reminded me how our grief needs to be witnessed. And they have a nonprofit organization, and that's how this kind of started. And after a number of meetings, you know, I said, you know, I studied grief a little bit in college, and combined, it's a topic that I've always been interested in and am fairly educated on, sort of from a, you know, objective standpoint mixed with personal experience. I said, I think we could make a documentary, and then me being a filmmaker, of course. So I said, I think we could make a documentary if you really want to get a wider reach here. And so that's kind of how it all started. And then now we have this film that became much bigger than I had ever anticipated.
It's true, because at some point everybody will experience some sort of grief and to different levels. And there's so many facets to it, right? The age in which we experience grief, the relationship, how important that person or thing was to us that we have lost, but also our understanding of our own self and our purpose in this world. I think when you lose somebody, for instance, it really makes you, I think if you're a thinking person, take a stark look at your own life, right? How are you living? And really, you know, is it where you want it to be? So for instance, when my father passed, the grief was tremendous, not just because he was my father, but I realized in hindsight, and that's why, to your point, this mourning experience is so necessary and it's important to talk about, because I realized that the pain that I felt was really pain for him not fully living the life that he had intended, right? He had so much regret when he had passed. And so that was so painful for me, more than losing him and not being able to create new memories with him. That was my own pain as a daughter, but I had tremendous pain for him, because I know that when he left, he felt it was unfinished, and he was sick for 7 years leading up to his death. So he went through a lot of hardship. And then with my grandmother who just passed, she lived until she was almost 98. And my four children got to experience their great grandmother, which is rare, for many, many years. And she lived a full and complete life. So it was almost a celebration when she passed, right? And I think that that's why it's such an interesting and important conversation, because we are supposed to derive purpose and meaning from the things that we lose and from the grief that we experience.
Mm-hmm. I have a few things I want to say or ask you about that. One, my grandma passed during the making of the film, like towards the end, and she too was 98. And she got to see her great grandchildren, which was very special as well. This is such a unique situation. And it certainly is a different type of loss than perhaps one like your father. When you mentioned he was sick for 7 years, so I imagine you must have experienced a tremendous amount of anticipatory grief leading up to his eventual passing. And then how are you, what is your relationship with that grief today?
That's interesting, because when I watched your documentary, that stood out, anticipatory grief, and I wrote it down to actually touch upon, because for the 7 years, and he had cognitive decline, so towards the end he couldn't remember himself or his three daughters. However, when I started to, so at first my response, and I think we should talk about the five stages of grief as well, but my response was somewhat denial, but I knew it was there, but I avoided it, right? So I just kind of looked the other way. And it was kind of convenient because I lived in New York and he was still in LA. So, you know, it was like, oh, well, I'm not living there. I had that kind of freedom, let's say, for lack of a better word. And then I had the epiphany one day, and maybe it was the anticipation of what was coming. But I remember thinking that he is here now. And although he looked like he was suffering to me, and it was scary what I was seeing, he was still very much alive, right? He was very much present. So I was going to meet him where he was at. And that was a really profound shift for me. So for instance, I would go to he would go to this community center every day, and he had some friends there, and I would go and visit him there. And I would go to his house also, but I would go with the intention of, I have no expectation. It's not about me. It's not about my experience, but I just want to meet him where he's at. So that's what I did. If he was silly one day, then we were silly together. If he spoke in a made up language, I would speak in that language with him. If he was sad, we would just hug and hold. And I feel like that really prepared me for, more than letting go, kind of accepting and connecting, right? And it prepared me for when he left. But that's why the pain, though, when he left was so shocking, because it wasn't my pain. It was really his. And I think it created some fear about death and suffering for me. I mean, it did in a different way. So I don't know if that's grief, but that was the aftermath of the grief, let's say.
I would say grief is everything that we feel or experience or think or encounter. Anytime there's that shift in our lives, anytime a person that was close to us is gone, there's, you know, we talk about that in the film too. There's going to be grief, a type of grief associated with that loss, with that change.
Yeah. So I still feel that. Let's call it grief. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's perfectly normal to still feel that. And you'll feel, I imagine, something for the rest of your life. It might not always be the same. I think it changes as we change and we move forward with the grief, because it's part of us, rather than, you know, getting over it, as some people would want to think we can do.
I think it was Adam Rapp who said this in your documentary: grief doesn't expire, it simply changes temperature, which I really liked.
Oh, yes.
Anthony quoted, so that was right, yeah.
That was Anthony's brother, Adam, who had written that in his play. And that was his play Nocturne, which is a tremendously profound line.
It is.
I think, you know, Anthony said it because he believes that to be true. And I believe that to be true as well, that it changes. It's still grief, but it just changed. Like, I think it says that it changes color, you know, as you move forward. One day your grief could be a fond memory, you know, that could be grief. And then another day it could be an extremely painful part of it, an extremely painful memory, or, you know, just, it could be a physical feeling too. It's so many different things.
What's interesting, that temperature shift. Sometimes when I'm working out, I work out at a place and I don't control the music, and a song will come on, like the Gypsy Kings that he loved, right? And the first 2 years after he passed, I would hear it and I would just remember the pain, right? The fact that he didn't achieve what he wanted. And then now when I hear it, it's sweet again. Like, I remember him dancing and enjoying it. It's a little bitter sometimes, but for the most part, it's kind of my memory now is him and his joy and his happiness. So, yeah, I think that that's a good example of that.
I think that's beautiful. I've heard other people say that before too, that, yeah, you know, it's sort of this assigning new meaning to something as you continue to move forward, as you continue to live on, and how do you honor their memory, you know? And if you can find a way to where it's not always a sad story, it's not always sad, and there are ways that you can find to remember in a different way to honor them, to honor their memory. Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the things that I thought was really beautiful in the documentary, there's a quote, I think it might have been Ron Marasco, if I'm not mistaken, and he spoke about the fact that grief is really proof of love, right? Mm-hmm. That the reason, my understanding was that we feel grief is because we loved, and actually we continue to love.
And the deeper, the more profound your grief is, the more profound your love.
Right, was. And it reminded me, actually, as Monica mentioned, her grandmother passed away literally a week ago. And one of the things that was always constant, her husband, Monica's grandfather, passed away probably 20 years ago, right? A long time ago.
Well, he had a stroke in 92, but yeah. Probably 20 years
more ago. More than 20 years ago. And she always spoke about wanting to reunite with him. Like literally almost every conversation, every other conversation, she would talk about her love for him, how much she misses him, and how much she would want to reunite with him. And I heard, and I wasn't there, but I heard that literally in the last hours of her life, she was calling out her husband's name was Amir. And she just kept calling out to Amir, which I thought was so beautiful, because it really both sort of highlights that idea that you know, grief is very much related to love. And I guess at the end of it, and this is, you know, my own interpretation, it actually brings us back to love, right? As she's going through her death process, she recounts and tries to connect to her deceased husband.
Right. And it's that type of love doesn't go away. And there's no time. It's like, it's almost as if time is irrelevant in those types of circumstances too. I mean, calling out to someone, like it was just yesterday when you said it had been, what, 20, 30
over 20 years
or
yeah.
so, you know, and they probably felt it just in that moment as if it was, they were still with them or going to be with them again.
Exactly.
I found that we can learn a lot about living by watching people we love die, which I did in with my mother-in-law and my father. One of my favorite verses from Ecclesiastes is, it's better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting, for that is the end of all men, and the living will take it to heart. So it's the idea that death exists for most to teach us how to live. Have you learned any lessons about life through experiencing loss? It's a big question.
it's hard because sometimes, depending on the type of loss, it can create more questions than, you know, teachable lessons. Like my uncle passed towards the end of this production when I was filming this, and he had been sick and he was fairly young. And similarly to what you were saying about your father not being able to experience and achieve all the things that they wanted to achieve in life, I'm often left with questions as to why they're not able to achieve those things. And then you learn about your own mortality in that way too, where you question, will I be able to achieve all the things I want to achieve? You know, so for lessons, I don't know if I have an answer for that other than the sort of cliche ones of live every day as if it's your last, tell those you love that you love them. But it's so incredibly complex that, and I think, you know, sometimes depending on how you were raised, we're told, you know, not to ask questions and to trust. And I think there's something inherently human about questioning these types of losses, you know, questioning these losses when you thought you were supposed to have a future with that person, or they were supposed to have a future. So it's incredibly complicated. And I don't know if I have an answer to that question specifically.
Fair enough.
That's kind of where it led me.
I think we have these conversations, Michael and I, often together, because when something seems unfair or it's not clear why, we kind of just look at each other and we're like, we're not that smart. We don't have all the answers and we're not going to figure it out, but we definitely use it as a motivator for change. You know, I think I almost overdid it with my father. I was like, oh, he ran out of time. I'm going to go double speed, triple speed to make sure I achieve everything I need to. And then I'm like, I'm exhausted. I don't think this is the way I should be living either. But I was able to then kind of find the middle of making sure that I really guard my time well and I don't waste it on frivolous, nonsensical things or worrying about what people think. Or like, I really took it to say, okay, where am I spending energy and time where it could be better used for what I really want to achieve in this world, right?
I think that's actually a large part of it. At least for me, it has helped me discover the things that I'm truly passionate about. It kind of like creates this like stark contrast of, okay, I definitely know I don't want to do that, and I really enjoy this. So how can I, you know, find joy doing this while I'm here? So that, you know, for me, I mean, like during the pandemic, during like lockdown, it certainly, I was alone by myself through that whole thing. And I discovered a lot of things that I really enjoyed, like singing. And, you know, I'm an actor too. So I do musicals and that is just, it's never been more apparent than after suffering loss at how passionate I am for those things. So I think grief can bring out positive things in you too, and teach you things about yourself that you didn't realize before. And I think that's a positive. That could be a sort of meaning making in a sense. I mean, it was for me,
at least. It's interesting. I was, you know, my mom passed over 3 years ago, and for me, it wasn't so much new lessons, but it really crystallized three things for me. It was one, you know, that idea of you know, really what are the important things in life, right? For me, always being around death, certainly when it was so close and we actually, you know, were there for the final minutes and hours. So that was one, and really shifted things that I, you know, spend time doing and not spend time doing. And the second was, you know, this idea of, you know, caring what other people think. Right. We often, you know, sort of get upset about certain things. And I ask myself the question, if this was the cliche, but if this was your last day, your last hour, is this something that would upset you, disappoint you or not? Right. And the reality is that that's a very small list. And the third thing is it crystallized appreciation, which again, is kind of a cliche, but it really became, you know, this understanding of the finite amount of time we actually have here with our loved ones, with doing things that are truly important to us. So like you said, I think it affects all of us differently, but for me, it wasn't any new understanding, but it was a crystallization of things that I had always been thinking about.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think about in terms of grief, like I always had a fear of death, and I think my father's passing and the way that he passed, but also I think it intensified that fear in some way. And when I was growing up, he would often say, if I ever become a vegetable, make sure you just cut the cord. Like horrible. Like who? I was seven. I'm like, and then I was 10 and then it was 13. And it's like in the words that he used, even it wasn't even like there's a nicer way to say that. Right. But that's specifically exactly what he said. So then when it started to happen, I was like, oh my God, is this life? Then what I decided to do proactively was, okay, we'll make your life a beautiful life. And when it's a beautiful life, yes, the pain of loss, of course, is tremendous. But for the person, it's a different experience. Like, it's complicated. I wonder, I guess my question really is your fear of death, if somebody has more of a fear of death, is it harder to grieve? Or is it if they have a life they love, is it then hard? Because it brings us back to that idea of tremendous loss, like finite, right? Even if it's not only death we're speaking about.
Yeah, the hard thing about this is that there's no one person that can give you an answer about grief because it's so incredibly individual. And so it's kind of one of those things that what works for some might not work for others. And you have to just allow space to be, you know, introspective and turn inward and ask yourself the questions, because it's tough. I mean, I I could sit here and answer these questions all day and it could resonate with people, or people can say, that's not correct at all. That's not my experience. So it's such a unique thing. There are no two grievers alike. So it's just, you know, finding the things that work for you in those moments that you feel it, you know, it might work for you in the short term, it might not work in the long term, you know.
And it's constantly changing, you know.
It's constantly changing. So like, for an example, like if someone is grieving and they say, I need to drink scotch right now, you know, that's great. Do that. Go, you know, drink your drink. And it perhaps will not be good for you in the long run, but that's what they need in that moment. And that's what we need to be able to honor. And kind of goes back to meeting people where they are, you know, as long as I believe, as long as they're not, you know, truly hurting themselves or hurting others, grieve how you have to grieve and experience it the way you need to.
Well, yeah, we have a friend who did exactly that. How many bottles of scotch? By his father's grave.
Oh, right. Well, it was one bottle in a short amount of time.
Yes.
That'll do it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to, one of the really fascinating subjects in the documentary is David Kessler. And I understand also as well that you studied with him, or at least his mm-hmm. method. So maybe give us, maybe our listeners especially, a little background on him. I know he worked with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross as well. So I just found him very fascinating. So maybe you can share a little bit about him, how you came to know him, and maybe, you know, what you learned from him.
Absolutely. So, David, actually, Julie Shaw, who's also in the film, the two of us met in David's certification program, becoming certified grief educators. And David, as you mentioned, he had worked directly with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, who, for those who don't know, you know, developed the five stages of grief. And David has done a tremendous job at really explaining those stages and carrying on her legacy of, you know, their original intent versus how people perceive them and kind of how they've gotten misconstrued over the years. So,
do you mind sharing? I think that's really important.
Yeah,
if you don't mind going into that, to that.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm never sure like who knows this and yes, who doesn't.
I always assume that people don't know. And if they know, they can use a reminder.
Yeah. So, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross used to work with terminally ill patients, and she noticed these trends of people that were dying. And so she developed these stages, which were the original intent was they were the five stages of dying. And over the years, people acknowledged that this is kind of what grievers experience as well.
That was moving not, sorry, forward. So Elizabeth Kubler-Ross herself did not directly tie it to grieving, only to dying?
They were adapted, I would say, with her and David together. So it's originally started with the needs of the dying, which is one of the titles of one of the books. She noticed these people that were terminally ill were going through these stages, and I don't know who specifically, but I think it was like a collective experience determining that these could also be applied to people experiencing grief as well. This is where the confusion comes in. They may happen to you. They may not, in no particular order. You may bounce back and forth between anger or bargaining or depression. It's not linear. And so I think if someone has no knowledge of grief or no knowledge of the five stages and they experience a major grief in their life, we have this desire to go, okay, I heard about these stages. What are they? Let me see if I can go through 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And then when I get to acceptance, I'll be done, you know? And, you know, David and Elizabeth, they were very explicit about these stages are not prescriptive. It's not the magic pill. Rather, it's descriptive of what you might go through. And like I said, it doesn't happen in order. And it's certainly not something that once you get to acceptance, you're done. And one of the women I interviewed in the film said, and I had never heard it said like this before, she said, acceptance is more like resignation, like you resign to the fact that it's true, that it happened, but acceptance shouldn't be the word we use, because it's not acceptable to lose a loved one, you know? So they exist and you may experience them. It's likely that you will experience anger. It's likely that you will experience depression or bargaining. You know, bargaining is really interesting because I think that is the most human one that's never really talked about. Bargaining could be, you know, like, if I do this, if I go to church on Sunday, will my person not die? You know, if I start making changes in my life, will I not die? If I start going to the gym every day, will you spare me? Will you give me more year? Or on the flip side, looking at it from the other end, once a person has already passed, the bargaining could be, oh, if only I didn't go to lunch that day with my best friend, but then I would have been there for this. So bargaining is a very human thing to do. And that one's the stage that's not often talked about, because I don't think people really know what it means or what it can mean.
Well, it's interesting. We have four children. Our second son was born with Down syndrome, and we found out 3 hours after he was born. And it's interesting because as we were speaking, I wasn't even going to share this today, but as we were speaking, I'm thinking, I started checking the list because I really grieved more than any person that I've lost through death. I really grieved the child I thought I was caring for 9 months and the child I thought I would have. And so when he was born, and I was shocked, right? Because we didn't expect it. I was very young also. The doctor that delivered the news did not have a great bedside manner. I mean, it's just a lot of things. So it just came at me. And I absolutely went, it's interesting because there's one stage I skipped and there's one that I added. So absolute denial, like, no, this does not make sense. This is not part of like my life plan. And how could it happen? No, I didn't get angry. I went straight to bargaining. And what that looked like for me was I asked the doctor to do the test again. I was like, you got it wrong. And I remember, and I had to convince them to do it. And as I was waiting for the results, boy, did I bargain. God and I sat down and I was like, I will do anything. Just don't make this be a reality for me. I can't handle it. And I was like, I'll do this and I'll do that. I had a whole list. Just make this thing not be true. Then the test came back, and then I went straight to sadness, depression. And then the added one was anxiety, because I felt like, and I think that was right before acceptance, which, by the way, the word I like to use is surrender, right? Because you're surrendering to what is. It doesn't mean that you might love it or you might not, but now you've surrendered to the reality of what is, and you can choose your response. That was my experience in this situation. But just before that surrender, that was like full on panic. I cannot handle this. I cannot do this. I don't know how to raise a child with Down syndrome. And then ultimately was surrender. And by the way, he's the biggest blessing. I wouldn't change a thing. Love him more than anything. He's made me a better human, taught me more in life than any wise old sage teacher. And really, but I went through those stages exactly like that. And then by the way, sadness came back in and out for a good year or two. If it was like he didn't meet a milestone, or if somebody was rude or stared at him, or whatever the case may be. Right. But yeah, absolutely.
I've heard many people talk about the anxiety being, I mean, there's a book, Clara Bidwell Smith wrote a book. I think it's just called Anxiety, The Missing Stage of Grief.
Oh, really?
Oh, that's interesting.
I didn't know that. I love that I actually just connected that. Yeah.
Well, because we do experience, I mean, in my experience, I remember thinking, it sounds silly, but I remember thinking what a blessing it was that I wasn't struggling with anxiety because I was so depressed and or sad, you know, in my experience. And so it's just so interesting how that can happen. I want to point out what you were saying about how you asked them to do the test again, and you just sat and you prayed for it. And the one thing I struggle with, and I always ask people this too, is, you know, what do you do when you pray as hard as you can, you bargain as much as you can, and you believe something to be true, and the result is not what you originally thought it was going to be? What do we do then?
Well, I'll tell you what I did. And I really, this is the advice I give to our listeners and our students. I realized that what needed to change was not the result, but me and how I wanted to experience life and how I really viewed things. I realized that what I desired wasn't really ultimately what I needed. And I'm in it to win it, right? Like, I want to be a person that is going to change and to evolve and to grow and enter, leave the world differently than how I came in, right? So I really appreciate that part of life and that process. So then I thought, okay, if you really believe that, then you have to trust that there's something beautiful in this experience for you, even though you can't see it right now. So I really searched for it and I really looked for it. I didn't see it as a proof that God doesn't exist or that my prayers don't go answered or that I'm not good enough or I'm not worthy of that. I really looked at it as I need to shift my perspective from seeing this as something that I don't want to a blessing, right? And it was in a package mm-hmm. that looked like a brown paper bag. But if I opened it and really opened and peeled the layers, there was something beautiful there waiting for me. And that's how I really approached life, especially the challenging moments. I took that changed me so completely, because that's the truth, right? In life, we're going to be changed by things, especially the difficult things. Our own free will that we have, the power that we have, is how we choose to change. You're going to be changed. You'll be changed by every loss, every death, every challenge, every struggle. What you can do is choose the change. And that's what I focused on.
I think that's great. It's powerful.
So I want to go back a little bit to David Kessler, because what I found fascinating, again, is that he dedicated his life early in life to studying right death and hospice care, and then he was already in it, right? And then he experienced the death of his son.
So backing up a bit, he lost his mother when he was 13 or 14. Now, this is such an interesting story. So at the same time his mother was dying in the hospital, across the street from the hospital was one of the first like mass shootings in the country. And so as a young boy experiencing death on such a grand scale, and they all went into lockdown, and it was just a whirlwind of an experience for him. And I joked with him recently. I was like, so how did you go into being a grief expert after this, a grief specialist? And he was like, but of course, right? But, you know, originally he had told me, because I had talked to him, I said, you know, David, like I'm Grant, who's funny and I act and I sing. And now I've done this film. And so people are always talking to me about grief, which is fine. I'm always happy and honored to be part of any discussion about it. I said, but where's that balance? You know, and he said, well, this is the Grant that they're experiencing now. But then when you do a musical or you do a different film, that'll be the version. And he said, when he was younger, he had been writing a novel. He wanted to write different types of books. And then Elizabeth talked to him and said, I think you should write this next book with me. And he said he had tried to, you know, reject it for so long. He didn't want to be the grief guy until finally he felt that it was right for him. And he said he felt that he had known everything there was to know about grief until, I want to say it was maybe six or seven years ago now, his son, his younger son, David, died suddenly. And he said, I felt like going back to everyone that I'd ever talked to in grief and saying I didn't know how bad the pain was, how bad the experience was. And yeah, there's a number of people in our film that we had spoken to who had lost children. And that's often looked at as, you know, the worst type of loss. And I'm not here to argue that one way or another, but David talks about the worst grief is the one you're experiencing. And that's an interesting take on it. And I've talked to him about that before too, because it kind of confuses me. But when you're in a major grief experience, that's your whole life. It's all encompassing. And so of course that's the worst, because it's what you're experiencing in that moment. I'm sure people will fight me on that too, but that's what I've got from him. Did that answer your question?
Yeah. Yes. Yes. I was going to wish one more to that. So do you think, he says that, like he says also as well in the documentary, but do you think it really changed him, his view on grief as a whole, right? Having experienced the death of his mother at such a young age, the mass shooting, and then so many years later, after having been teaching and writing about grief for so long, experiencing his child passing, was that a real shift in his view of an understanding and teaching of grief?
Well, I mean, I think it would have to be for anyone. I mean, the way I look at grief, there's, you know, I've read dozens of books on grief, right? But nothing in the books allows you to feel or experience what you would feel in your own lived experience. It's like taking a class on business. And then you want to go open your own coffee shop. That class isn't going to really teach you how to run your own business. It's going to give you a general breakdown of what you may encounter. And I think if anything, you know, books or even our film, you know, my goal with the film was just for it to resonate with people so they felt like they weren't alone. Like these feelings are normal that they're having. We wanted to validate people's experience and let them know that, yes, it's bad and it's also normal to feel this way. But yes, I think it did certainly change to a degree his view on it. He had mentioned that he would go to grief groups, something that he would normally lead. Now he was a participant.
Right.
No, I think that it's such a true statement, and that everybody's grief is immense, right? It's not that one is more than the other. I think though, part of it, when a person loses a child, for instance, or when they lose somebody at a younger age, I don't think it's even so much about that loss, but all of the things that they thought they would experience with that person. It's all of the narratives that we have, the stories, the movies in our head of, oh, you know, when you're this age, we're going to do that. Or when I walk, you know, I'm going to get married, you'll be the, it's all of that, right? That color. And I think that that's what sometimes makes grief feel even more profound, right? When you have less days with somebody, but more than that, you thought it's what you thought it would be.
Yeah, it's that you're grieving the future you thought you were going to have too. So that's an added element of it, as opposed to like how you mentioned, you know, your grandmother or my grandmother who lived these, what we would call full lives, almost 100 years. And what's interesting about that was what you were saying about people that experience loss at a young age. I've encountered people who have said, you know, who have lost children or lost somebody at a young age, and you get these seemingly that's the same type of loss, but it's wildly different experiences. So I've had people tell me, you know, they're up in heaven with God and that's a beautiful thing. And then I've had other people say, I'm mad at God. And why did God do this? And so, you know, that's kind of where we have to look in at our own reactivity to the situation and kind of determine for ourselves what's best for us in those moments.
Well, I've heard you talk about grief and gratitude coexisting, and it's a profound idea, but it's also really difficult because, you know, and people, oh, yes. You know, I remember again, when I had Josh, my second son, the pediatrician called the house 4 days later, and our firstborn was 4 and he answered the phone because I was in bed depressed at that point. And it was my OBGYN. And so he asked our son, David, you know, is your mom there? He handed me the phone. And at the end of the conversation, he's like, you know, just remember you have another child too that needs your love and attention. And I remember hearing that at the time thinking, okay, well, you're right. I appreciate what you're saying. But right now I feel like being in bed because that's what I need in this moment. Right. Mm-hmm. And it felt just a little bit, insensitive, but I know that's not what his intention was. So I think that it's, you know, people say like, you have this to live for, you should appreciate that. So it's like a fine balance. And also it's hard when you are grieving. I remember when my father passed, I was grieving, but then I also have young children and I have joy and I enjoy them. And it was going back and forth between the two. It's very hard to navigate.
Right. And yeah, so you're right. I have talked about gratitude and grief a number of times, and let me try and explain it in a way that it makes sense. I think oftentimes there's this like rush to gratitude. Like the second after somebody passes, someone will tell you, oh, think of all the other good things in your life. Think of all the other kids you have. Think of, oh, you know, be grateful for your health. Be grateful that you have. It's like most of the time that person has probably already thought that, but it's not doing anything to take the pain away. And so what I like to acknowledge is that both of those can coexist. The gratitude and the grief can coexist. It's never like in harmony, but it's something that one doesn't erase the other. It's not like, oh, well, I have other children and therefore I'm not going to experience the grief of this. That's not, it's just, it doesn't work that way. But I like people to know it's something that exists as an option, perhaps as you move forward with your grief, as time goes on, can I learn to be grateful for the other parts of my life? Or for me, I'm very grateful for the person I've become experiencing grief. Like I love this version of me now. Did I want the grief? No, I wish it had never happened. And at the same time, I'm grateful for all the things that I've learned about myself and others as I've moved forward with the grief.
Yeah, beautiful. One of the things, as we were talking about a minute ago, which I found so beautiful in the documentary, is this idea that, right, grief isn't just about the loss of that individual or that relationship. It's also who we were going to be, right? Because we become a different person, a different version of ourselves with each relationship that we have. And part of the grieving process that we won't have more opportunities to be that new person. Maybe speak, if you can, a little bit to that point, which I thought was so beautiful and I think a new concept, I think, to many people.
That is a part of grief that we often do not talk about. Like, you know, who I was as a husband, I am no longer. Or who I was as a son or a brother, I'm no longer that. Because I was the only one that had that relationship with that person because it was us as individuals. And so you are also grieving who you were to them. Your relationship to that person was unique and like no other. And so you grieve being that person to them. You grieve being that brother or that child or that partner to them or that best friend to them. And so that part of you is also gone with them. And we don't often think about that. You know, you don't get to say the same joke that you used to say to your best friend, you know, and that was unique to that relationship. And so that goes with them too. And yeah, that's a incredibly devastating part of grief that we don't think about, that our relationship to that person is also gone and who we were as a person to them is gone.
Yeah. And another, I think, very important point, probably in the title, right? This idea, because I know I used to struggle with this. We have many people around us and we're all always, unfortunately, not always, but fortunately not always, but, you know, very often, you know, being called upon by people who've lost a loved one. And for me, I remember initially always saying, oh my God, what am I going to do to make them feel better? And I felt this sort of responsibility. And then I realized, no, it's not your responsibility, nor even is what they want for you to make it better. They want you, and I think this was a, right, meet me where I am, just be there. And as it says in the documentary, hold space. So maybe you can share a little bit with our listeners. I think maybe that really important idea when we are a friend or a family member to somebody who is grieving, you know, what the documentary teaches us about how we should show up and really what we should be thinking
and
about.
Also what to say. I mean, right. Don't say, I offer my condolences or I was like taking notes there because people are at a loss. Then they want to seem empathetic and they are, but they're uncomfortable. Right.
So I asked pretty much everyone that I spoke to, I said, you know, what were some of the most helpful things people did or said for you after your loss? And what were some of the most maybe not helpful things? Almost everyone said my condolences was one of the worst things that they heard because
never using that again.
It does absolutely nothing. And And what surprised me was that everyone said some of the best things people did were the people who were just there. The ones who did not try to fix anything. The ones who did not try to like get me to get out of the house and go to the movies or something. And so the people who are just there. But I think that it's important to remember that we need to assess the relationship we have to the person, because that'll help inform us how we should respond and how we should show up for them. So for example, you might have some, you know, especially now with like social media, it's like, I'll see online that someone I went, you know, to elementary school with's parent died and I haven't talked to them in 30 years. So am I going to show up at their house with dinner? Probably not. But if there's a friend that I'm closer with or a person I'm closer with, maybe depending on that relationship, maybe a text is sufficient, a text message, perhaps a phone call, perhaps showing up at their house, perhaps going on a walk with them. So it really just depends on the relationship. But I know what surprises grievers oftentimes are the people that they thought were going to be there were not, and the ones that they didn't think were going to be there show up in ways that they never imagined, and they're grateful for that too. So it's because we're so grief illiterate and we don't know what to say, so we get scared and we don't say anything. And if you're looking for something to say, I think we should all just start with, I'm here, and then kind of build upon that. And, you know, I think giving people tangible things is helpful too, as opposed to saying, you know, let me know if you need anything. I'll just wait. I'll wait back here. Let me know if you need anything. And that's often not helpful because the griever is like, they don't know what they want. They don't, and now they have to like figure out an agenda for everyone to do things for them and delegate tasks. That's not going to work. So I've found, you know, if you know their favorite restaurant is, you know, this pizza, they love pizza from this place or something, it could be helpful to just give them like a tangible item. Like, would you like pizza from your favorite restaurant tonight? Yes or no? And then they can just in that moment be like, yes, no, it's very simple. They don't have to like figure something out. So it is about showing up and being there, but also assessing the relationship you have to the person, I think.
Absolutely.
I think that the thing with grief and mourning, it's very isolating because it's really just happening to you because that was your unique, specific relationship with that person. And I remember the thing that touched me the most when my father passed, a friend flew in from St. Louis, where she lives, and she just knocked on my door. She didn't tell me she was coming. She knocked on my door and she stayed for a few hours and then she flew back. And that feeling of, wow, this person really feels my pain and I'm clear about that. And she went to such great lengths and made herself uncomfortable to come do this for me was just, I mean, it took some of the pain away, to be honest.
Yeah. I was going to share as well that so when my father passed away, which is almost 11 years ago now, my most profound memories from that, from his funeral, was not anything anybody said or what anybody did, but there were a few people who I was just surprised that they took he was buried in Israel, so who took the time and a flight from New York, from Los Angeles, from anywhere else in the world, and flew 10 hours, 12 hours just to be there.
And hug you.
And hug me.
And
they didn't say anything. They didn't do anything. But just that was really the most beautiful and most profound experience that I had with friends during that time.
I've heard that from many people before. You know, when my father passed, I remember my cousin came up to me and just gave me a hug and didn't say anything. And that hug was like really profound in that moment. It was like kind of what we needed right then. And that I think speaks to this sort of meeting people where they are. Oftentimes you don't need to say anything. You don't need to speak. You don't need to, sometimes you can just sit there with them, just to be there with them, you know, hold their hand, go on a walk with them, maybe just be there while they sleep, let them fall asleep on the couch. You know, I think just having that presence sometimes can be helpful to just be there for them.
Yeah, you reminded me, Monica often shares this story, but after our second son Josh was born with Down syndrome, we come home and my father walks into our, we were in bed, we were, you know, weren't that happy. And so we're just lying in bed and my dad just comes in, takes a chair and just sits by the side of the bed.
He sat quiet. There for 45 minutes, quiet. 45 minutes just sat there. And then before he got up, he said, "It didn't just happen to you." And I was like, I mean, again, took like half of the pain away. I think that, you know, it's really, if you think about it, that's what people want in life always, whether it's in a relationship or passing somebody in the street, people want to be seen and heard. And I think it's more impactful and necessary, especially at these kinds of moments in our lives, to feel that.
Absolutely. Grief needs to be witnessed.
Towards the end of the documentary, this point is made, but this quote from the documentary, which I want to quote, what we run from pursues us. What we face transforms us.
That's a good quote.
That's David. Yeah, that's David.
Yeah.
I talked to him about that. So he, I think he writes about it in his book. That was actually about buffaloes.
Oh, really?
Believe it or not. And that he said, I never thought I'd be studying buffaloes, writing a book about grief, but I think it was buffaloes. And he said that buffaloes, when there's a storm, they run into the storm to minimize the amount of time they're experiencing it. And so what I've learned is in grief, and Anthony says it too, you have to go through it to sort of get through it. It's going to be there. And so you just, it'll always be there. So you have to experience it. You really do have to go through that storm because it's not going to just disappear. If you ignore it, it's not going anywhere. It'll be waiting there for you. And so that's kind of what that was about. What we run from pursues us. What we face transforms us.
Right. And then I think, the point I think is made in the documentary tour that a lot of the people interviewed who experienced loss and grief, they did find a way to make meaning from it, right? That I think, I don't know if that, you know, brought them to another level of grief or transforming their grief, but it definitely, certainly those who did use it as an impetus to start doing something positive with it, whether I thought that's why I understood it, right? That they used it and sort of went into it, through it, and then also used it to benefit. And I think that at least in the way I heard them, it did in some way, I don't know if the word is alleviate the grief or transform the grief in one way or the other.
Well, I think, and that part was very, it was very important for me to have that section in the film to show that like there are options, like as we move forward, there are things that can be different. There are things that we can experience that we never thought we could experience. You know, the one thing people don't talk about in grief is that you meet new people that you never knew existed, and you can have new relationships and new beginnings, and that's all kind of part of life. Like we kind of think that way a little bit anyway, but we don't think of it in terms of grief and how connected we can become through it. But the meaning making portion was important to me. And I just want to say too, making meaning is not like, you don't need to start an organization. You don't need to make a documentary or write a book on it. Meaning can be just like, I got up out of bed today and I took a shower, or I shaved today. You know, meaning is what we make of it. And so like, I think it's meaningful now that you and I are having this conversation because it can be helping someone, you know, it can be helping someone have a different perception of it. You know, one of the things I wanted people to walk away from this film was like, as a griever thinking like, oh, I never thought about it that way. Or for someone that wanted to help people, oh, I didn't realize I could do that to be there for them, or say that or not say that. And so, yes, the meaning making was people, I think, and I said it before and I'll say it again. I think meaning is moving for being able to move forward with your grief and make new meaning as you move forward. And it doesn't erase the loss. It kind of goes back to gratitude and grief. You can make new meaning with your loss and honor their memory.
Absolutely beautiful. So besides, of course, having all of our listeners watch Meet Me Where I Am,
which is available on demand through Apple TV and Amazon, where can our listeners find you?
Oh, they can find me on Instagram is where I am mainly. So at Grant_Gary, G-A-R-R-Y. But yeah, just search my name, Grant Gary. It's come for the grief, stay for the music is what I like to say, because a lot of my videos are of me on stage performing or singing. So, and they can follow the film on Instagram too, at Meet Me Where I Am Film. But yes, I do hope people watch it. Like you said, it's on Amazon Prime Video, Apple TV. I think you can get it on YouTube as well. And for those old school people, you can get a hard copy DVD.
Seriously? You made that's very fine. That's,
wow.
Yeah.
Nice.
So, yeah.
Beautiful. Well, thank you so much for joining us. The documentary is beautiful. And I think we both learned, and hopefully our listeners, you know, can take away some really profound, you know, understandings both about their own grief and also dealing with others going through grief.
And I just love that you explored this topic. It's something that is necessary. We need to change our relationship, our understanding, our comfort level with grief and mourning.
Thank you. I feel I have one question. How, sure. You know, a lot of people are, I have such a warped view of the film now. There's no way for me to watch it for the first, like going into it as an audience member for the first time. So people are, I find people are often kind of, they kind of shy away from wanting to watch it. They feel that they have to be prepared to watch it. How do you feel in that regard?
No, it's a great question. I'm happy you asked it. I think that, again, we avoid things that scare us. And so nobody really wants to think about this, especially if they haven't experienced that yet in their lives. What I think is really profound about the film is that you are seeing real people being raw and honest and vulnerable and talking about their greatest pain, I think in the hopes to feel better, but to make other people feel better. So it's a beautiful experience, and it's a way to connect and see the beauty and the strength of human beings. And, you know, like some of the specific ones, the mother, one of the mothers who lost their child, and the grandmother was speaking, and she was saying, you know, there, somebody said to me, well, you can always, you know, foster a child, or you can adopt. And she was like, I don't want another child. I want that child, you know? And right. I just think it humanizes us and humbles us. That was my experience. And it's really, it's necessary. I think that we have to stop only talking about certain things. And by the way, for the most part, as a culture and a society, we speak about the wrong things, and we put energy in the wrong things, and we chase the wrong things. This is something that is true, that we experience, and that can bring us together and unify us in really a profound and beautiful way.
Mm-hmm. It's worth mentioning too, that story is about Lisa and her son and the grandmother. That was how this all started with Lisa's story. So she was our executive producer. That's how the whole thing started, was with them wanting to help others, really, and show others what people experience.
It's funny because that really stood out to me, that all of the people, but that one, I knew there was something else there just in the way that they shared. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, the only thing I would add to what you said is that I think that what it does, I think maybe almost analogous to grief, is that we don't necessarily always choose it, but it actually makes us a better person, hopefully. And I'm sure that by watching this film, you know, any person who watches it will actually walk away with something that makes them better, either again handling their own grief or dealing with others who are going through grief.
Or awareness.
I've talked to hundreds of people in grief, and so many of them are just delightful, you know, and that's the hope. Not that we wanted them to have that experience, but the fact that it can change us in a way that we never thought possible is kind of amazing too.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you for the film, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much. It was an honor to speak with you both.